Welcome to the Edible Valley Podcast. I am Blaine Prose.
And I'm Jonathan Fraser.
And we are here tonight with John's neighbor, Brian. Brian, I never got your last name.
McCormick.
Brian McCormick lives
downtown Courtney here.
Yep, right next door to John's house.
Just a little ways from the train tracks here. And we brought Brian in because not only is he a chef, he's a farmer, a gardener, and basically I think he has his hand into everything in food around here, or at least preparing and cooking it. So we thought he'd be an interesting guest to bring in and sort of talk about, you know, what you can do with a small property, a greenhouse, and curing meats and all those things. So
yeah, welcome, Brian.
Oh, it's great to be here. It's an honor to be your first guest.
Yeah, yeah, that's right, you are.
Going back, our first guest today, yeah.
Always a bunch of firsts. Everything seems like a first for this.
Yes.
Yeah. John, you got any food news? Things have been going on lately? I don't have anything off the top of my head, but...
It's pretty exciting because I know we're sitting here on April 10th today. And so the farmer's market is going to be moving into the exhibition ground starting on Saturday. So that'll be great.
I think the 14th?
The 14th, yeah. Yeah. So it'd be great to be out there. It seems like once they get outside of the Native Sons Hall, all of a sudden all the produce starts coming in.
And yeah, and the market doubles in size, I think.
Doubles in size, and there'll be a lot more to do. So kind of excited for that to be happening. What else is happening around town? I know there's the Shellfish Festival's coming up in June. I think that's the Father's Day weekend. So sounds like they've got a good list of chefs, a few out-of-town chefs coming in, and a bunch from... a bunch of local chefs here are going to be doing a nice gala dinner on, I believe, the Friday night. And then the Saturday at Marine Park, they've got a bunch going on with cooking demos. There's an oyster shucking competition, chowder competition. I think I might even do a demo down there. I'm not 100% cool. Sure how that'll work out. And so that's basically what's happening down around town. April 30th. Aaron Rail, executive chef at Avenue Bistro, which you worked with Aaron
for a while. Yes, I did.
Yeah, so Aaron's doing his chef's table down there, which is just an open family style table. And I think we're going to sneak into Beaufort Vineyard on the 16th. I think the Atlas and Avenue crew are going in there to do some sampling of this season's wine. So nice. I was going to join up with him, and we're going to do a pairing of the new wines with some dishes and stuff like that. So it should be an interesting evening. So that's pretty much, I know what's going on. There's a bunch of other events coming up as well. I know we were just talking earlier with Brian. You said down at...
At the Flying Canoe at the Westerly. I believe they're on Thursday. They're doing a cask night from... they're bringing up a cask from Phillips Brewery in Victoria. And so I guess they'll have that out there the day. It's like a small keg that they sort of make up specially for certain occasions. And
so it should be a nice, interesting
It'll be a different, interesting beer that they'll have. And it's sort of like a fresh beer. It's sort of only good for that night. They just sort of tap it, and the pressure that's in the keg is what's there, and they dish it out over the evening. I've never been to one before. I'm kind of excited to go down there and
excellent.
And see what they have to offer.
We've been sampling some Phillips beers tonight, actually, so... getting ourselves all primed for this. So.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of theirs, I should say, just because it's nice to have a brewery that does a bunch of different distinct beers and going.
In all the different seasonal beers.
That's the best part. So.
Yeah.
Definitely. I'm always interested in what's popping up in the liquor store because it seems to change every couple of weeks. It seems to be a new style of beer out there.
Yeah.
So. And yeah, so I guess that's about what's going on, and I guess we should get into a bit of interviewing here with Brian and getting a bit of his background.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about yourself. I know John did a pretty good job of bioing you there in the intro, but I'm sure you can add to that.
Well, I think there's a lot more, because you really came to the Valley and you owned a restaurant here.
Yeah, well, I moved to the Valley, I guess it was about 17 years ago. Shortly after moving here, we bought into a partnership at the Barn and Cafe, which was a vegetarian cafe restaurant in downtown Courtney.
And it's still talked about to this day, I think. There's still some old vegetarians out there that are like, oh, remember when the Bar None was here? And I used to get this. It was so good. So.
Yeah, there was a great sense of community that was kind of happened in the restaurant and stuff. And yeah, it was a great time for sure. But you know, we ran that for about 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
We were involved with the Bar None. And from there, I went on, and I did a little bit of farming with online farms. I spent a summer working outdoors doing that. It was one of the best summer jobs I've ever had. It was great.
Nice.
If you can make a little bit more money doing it, yeah. We do it all the time.
That's the challenge.
It is a challenge, yeah.
Yeah, because I used to get their greens. I think they were one of the first places, really, to go into the restaurant selling a lot of greens was online farm. So
yeah, they were. They were sort of like the first big sort of organic farm and
really pushing
in the valley, really pushing it. And
yeah,
they had their stuff in Thrifty's and a lot of other grocery stores and stuff. They were doing a really good job. And from there, I got a job down at the Westerly. Sort of started feeling my way back into the kitchen again after owning my own restaurant and feeling a little burnt out at the end of that.
Right, no kidding.
And then I went to work with Ronald down at the Kingfisher and mm-hmm. worked with him for 4 years down at the Kingfisher, and then followed him when he opened up his own restaurant, Locals.
Right, yeah.
Back in downtown Courtney. And,
so you were one of the lead people on that, setting that all up.
Yeah, helping him from getting it going, from painting the walls and staining tables and
all those fun
putting
things.
Everything together, right from the beginning, figuring out how we're going to lay out the kitchen to designing the menu and
mm-hmm.
getting it all going. For sure, it was a huge job. And
well, I mean, it's kind of an amazing restaurant in the sense that they go for every, it's all local ingredients, so it's really hitting what's in season and what's around, which is a little more difficult in somewhere like Courtney compared to somewhere like California.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
But it's amazing sort of what kind of started with Locals, because there is Jerry Patterson was started, you know, growing vegetables and stuff for Ronald to use. And as Ronald started asking for more stuff and for longer seasons, Jerry Patterson started opening the root cellar at the farm that hadn't been used there for forever.
Mm-hmm.
It's an older farm that he bought, and the root cellar hadn't been used for years. So he started storing more potatoes and carrots. He started putting some food by so that Ronald could have a longer season with some vegetables. And when he couldn't sell all his tomatoes within a certain week, he would start freezing them and then holding them and then sell them to locals throughout the winter. So for tomato sauces and stuff, we would have like sort of fresh local tomatoes all year round. So, you know, as he opened and started doing that, people started coming up with solutions and stuff for how are we going to supply stuff to him?
Well, I think that's one of the major challenges right now is we're pretty much slaves to the big groups right now. I mean, our major distributors, and it's nice to be able to get that local stuff because it's hard to get it. And I think it's just getting, you got to make that connection and you got to have a guarantee of a product being there because it's nothing worse than falling up short. And not that I think the big distributors will, you can't get rid of them. Like, there's just too much food demand for it, but it's just nice to get the local stuff and get the fresh stuff, you know.
It's a nice idea. I think something trying to be completely totally local and only doing it, you know, it might be a bit extreme. Like, there's stuff that you want, but I think looking at sort of what's in season locally, you can get strawberries from someplace all year round, but it doesn't taste like a strawberry all year round. It'd be nicer if we started, you know, recognizing the seasonality of some stuff and then trying to like really push the strawberries when our local strawberries are in season. And they're smaller, they're not as big as the huge Californian ones, but the flavor and it is so much different. And
The little strawberry like this has got twice as much in it as something that's, you know, the size of your hand.
Yeah, and fruit freezes so well like that too.
Yeah,
you put strawberries in the freezer and they're good for months, and then pull them out as needed and use them up. I was just given a big bag of strawberries by a friend that are, I think they're not last year's crop, but maybe the year before. They're still fine.
Mm-hmm.
I know they're just in a freezer bag with a zip or a twist tie on it, put in the deep freeze. Fantastic.
I think my only drawback at work is running out of freezer space.
Yeah.
I always try and get like a ton of blackberries in. get as much, get those fridges just packed full. But yeah, a month, 2 months later, it's all gone.
Yeah, it's pretty hard.
You're back to the old basics. So.
Yeah, hard to store that much.
Yeah.
Need to start canning them or something. Well, yes. I guess that takes up a lot of space,
well,
too.
Well, that's room, too. It's all about room and space. And that's the toughest thing for a restaurant, especially when you're busy, to have room to store all your food.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's lots of stuff that we can do at home at that with all that kind of stuff. I have lots of different sort of fruit plants. I sort of have done several different things in my yard. I have, you know, a nice space for, you know, growing greens and my squash and peas and beans and that stuff. And I've also have a nice big patch of raspberries, three apple trees now and a pear tree. I've planted a bunch of different currants, and so I try to make different jams, and I like making some of my own mead and stuff. So I'll harvest the raspberries. They're ever-bearing raspberries, so I just keep picking them throughout the season, and I'll put them in the freezer, and then I'll pull them out and make a big batch of jam, and then yearly I make a big batch of raspberry mead once a year, and try to find some stuff to do like that. And I macerated some raspberries and a bit of vodka to make a real nice sort of nice. Ice cream topper and a nice liqueur.
Yeah, something to get through the winter months.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and all that's done. Sorry, John. Oh. All that's done and grown on a city lot right in downtown Courtney. So it's pretty impressive what you can grow on a small parcel of land. Like,
it is. It's amazing how much stuff you can grow on a small parcel of land if you really sort of concentrate and focus on it, and just year after year experiment with stuff and try different things. And I haven't bought salad greens at home in the last 2 years. I grow my greens throughout the entire winter.
I think you grow my greens as well.
Yeah, I grow greens for a bunch of people. I do. I grow way more than I can eat myself. And
it's impressive, too, because your greens, it's like, I mean, they're right beside me, but I can, if I don't get to them that day, well, I don't get them a week later, the next weekend, they're still fresh, right? Like, they just seem to hold up so well.
Yeah.
In the fridge, which is, you know, a little...
Well, when you think of a lot of commercial greens and stuff, they may have been through wholesalers and distributors. They could be a week old by the time you get them. So when you get them, if you get 3 or 4 days out of them, you know, you're feeling good. Yeah. But when you get it straight from the garden and then into the fridge right away, in 2 weeks later, and not that you want to keep them in the fridge for 2 weeks,
well, not
but
that they last
it does
in my
happen.
Fridge for 2 weeks. They end up finding their way into something. But it's just impressive, and it's really amazing to see what you do. I mean, you do have a greenhouse.
Do have a greenhouse, yep. Which it's not heated. It's just polycarbonate clear sheeting that sort of covers it. It's a it was an old greenhouse that I got was given to me. It's just sort of a galvanized frame, and it sort of had like a semi-opaque cover for it. That never really worked well as a greenhouse, and right. I never was going to keep the cover to it. But I saw the frame, I was like, this is the perfect frame. And so I built a little post and beam foundation, cemented into the ground, and then anchored the frame to that, and then strapped it out with cedar, and then attached the polycarbonate to the outside of the greenhouse there. It does leave some kind of gaps here and there because the corners aren't, you know, all straight 90 degrees. It kind of had a slope to it, so it's hard to cut it at the angles to get good seals. But it works great just to modify the climate. I'm not trying to create a hothouse or anything and burn fossil fuels to heat it to grow tomatoes in the middle of the winter time.
Right.
But it modifies the climate enough that the greens and stuff survive through the winter. There is generally every winter a good solid week where everything's frozen solid in the greenhouse.
Oh, in the greenhouse itself.
And then it's just selecting your varieties that will survive the...
Right. So you do it a little hardier, like kales and stuff like that as well.
Yeah, a lot of corn salad, kales, chard, spinach holds up really well. Arugula, mizuna, I've never had a problem with.
All my favorites.
Yeah, and there's a few that I've been trying. This deer tongue lettuce, which seems to be quite hardy. Some romaines are fairly hardy through the wintertime. This winter was really quite mild. Things did freeze in the wintertime, but I did have some nice leaf lettuce that we shouldn't have made it any other winter that made it through. And And then outside of the greenhouse, I make some plastic cloches. I just have some plastic water line that I sort of bend over and sink into the ground, and then I just cover it with some regular plastic, and and I just have them open on the ends through the winter time, and it modifies the climate enough that it'll keep a lot of stuff growing through the winter.
Yeah, that was neat to go over and see what you had going on there. John was telling me about it, and it was cool to go see it. And then open up the garage, and he opens the fridge, and he's got two hams sitting in there that he's been curing for months. That was impressive, too.
Yeah, yeah, I started that last fall. Well, actually, last year, I sort of, I'd been watching some shows on TV, The River Cottage, out of, it's from the UK, where he kind of, he spends a whole season sort of trying to live off the land, just sort of forage from the wild. And then as the seasons progress, he sort of has like a cottage and gets pigs and chickens and sort of has, you know, shows sort of living off the land and getting closer to eating, eating closer to your food chain kind of thing. I'm not sure what I'm sort of trying to say, but yeah, where you're not importing stuff from Spain.
Yeah, you're just trying to eat off your own and what you can grow yourself.
So, so kind of inspired from that, I bought a pork shoulder and I salted it a couple years ago and then hung it in the garage, and it came out nice. It made a really nice Parma ham and sort of like a prosciutto styled ham.
Right.
And so this, so with that working out okay, I decided to buy half a hog from Tannadice Farms and so butchered that up and made some bacon and tried some salami. It came out okay. It was it's good for a first attempt, for sure. Totally happy with it. I've learned a lot from that, and well, I think I've learned that I need to get a sausage stuffer.
That's true, right there.
The sausage stuffer that I was using was the KitchenAid meat grinder, and I couldn't get the sausage stuffer on it to work right, and I ended up using the sausage stuffing attachment on a cookie press to fill all the...
little time consuming.
Yeah, so that was a little time consuming, and I found suppliers now for some better cultures and cures for the salami and stuff, so so I think next year we're going to have some nice salami.
Even.
Nice. Yeah, and I salted the legs and have them hanging in the garage for some nice
It just we were talking about this earlier, how it kind of feels wrong to be doing it, because you understand the process that's going through, that it's sitting in salt, but you're still hanging like almost a raw piece of meat in your backyard, you know. It kind of feels a little awkward in the food safe sense of it.
Right now they're hanging in a fridge, but throughout the winter I did have them just hanging open in the garage because they need that air circulation and the flow, and fridges, when they're curing, they're a little bit too cold. You need to have a slightly warmer environment for them to dry out, and a little better humidity than you find in the fridges. But you know, you follow your directions and you cross your fingers and you hope everything comes out okay. You know, you weigh it and you put it in the salt for the period of days it's supposed to, and you check it and you poke it to see if it's firm enough. And but it's always kind of odd hanging this uncooked piece of pork out in your garage. Yeah. But it's so rewarding when you try it. It's great.
You know, and that's, I think, where it boils down to, you know, you take the time to do it the right way, and you get an amazing, you know, product at the end. So.
Yeah, no, it's cool. You know, from smoking salmon and stuff, and that takes a matter of hours or overnight for a brine, and then it's in the smoker for a few hours, but it's a dedication to make a ham like that.
Yeah.
You're looking after that for a long time.
Mm-hmm. You are,
You're really involved. And yeah.
Some people wonder why you pay so much for those cured hams.
Yeah. And those ones are, I think most of the commercial ones are pretty much just mostly smoke cured, aren't they? The ham you buy in the store?
Some of them. I know that you have prosciutto ham and stuff that you can get sort of from Italy and stuff would be made in a similar fashion. Way, right? Yeah. Yeah.
You're in big rooms with racks and fire them in there. So, yeah.
They sit in there for months at a time.
But on the cost end of things, it's a great way to, you know, if you want to have like a prosciutto styled ham, and like you say with the salmon, smoked salmon. We live on the coast. We all have opportunities to buy like copious amounts of salmon once or twice a year.
Yeah. Exactly.
And you know, from the price that you pay from it, from like a whole fish to what you would have to pay for it if you were to buy smoked or candied salmon at the the cost of things today, it just makes sense to do it yourself.
Yeah. And at least just to help out with some of your expenses, right?
Yeah. Plus, and you can say, here, I made this.
Yeah.
Taste it. Enjoy it. Feedback. Let me know what you think. It's terrible. Well, maybe I don't think it is, but you do. Because I keep track of my brines and things. I pretty much use the same one all the time. But, you know, smoking times and not doing it too hot. Because I did a batch before Christmas. I thought it'd be great. I can bring to parties and stuff, but I smoked it way too hot and it just dried out, and it wasn't very good. I wasn't happy at all with it. Yeah. Then the last
it's amazing time, what cream cheese will do to smoked salmon.
Yeah, I should have smashed it all up. The last batch I did, I smoked it much cooler, and it still cooked it, but not to make it tough, so it's nice and tender and soft.
Yeah,
so it has a nice mouthfeel, and it doesn't. Feel like you don't feel like you need to have something to drink while you're eating it.
What kind of smoker do you use? Like one of the
I have a Bradley smoker.
Oh, okay, nice. Yeah.
So, and then I bought a pressure canner too. So I have some fish that I smoked, lightly smoked and brined, and then I canned.
Okay.
So that's really nice too.
I think this year I'm gonna try that for.
Yeah, it's really good. But you just gotta. You only want to brine it for a couple of hours, like maybe 3 or 4 hours, and then. With just a light salt brine, and then you only smoke it for about 2 hours.
Okay.
So, because if you do it too much, apparently it can get too strong. The canning will condense the flavors.
Yeah, because pressure canners and sort of the flavors that you add to things really changes the high temperatures.
So yeah.
I've read and had a little bit of experience with adding, you know, too much flavor and seasoning to something and then canning it, and then the end taste isn't. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and apparently sugar is really bad that way, so when you brine it to smoke it or to can it, you shouldn't add sugar to it because it'll get that burnt sugary taste, apparently. So I just took that warning and didn't use sugar.
Keep it natural.
Yeah, and I did it in a wet brine too versus a dry brine, which I usually do for my smoke. So anyway, that's just what I've been kind of figuring out, so, and it's been fun to play around with that. So
that's how what this whole thing sort of came to be with us sitting down and having these conversations. It's just so much stuff out there. And, like, where do you even start? Like, I mean, you could probably name 10 farms off the top of your head that have, you know, amazing food. I mean, you have your own. Do you still have your own farm, the wasabi?
Yeah, Nature Springs Wasabi. Not really. It's kind of, it's pretty much run its course. We started that, must be 15 years ago, 14 years ago. Growing wasabi, partnered up with Edgar Smith at Beaver Meadow Farms, and we bought a bunch of wasabi and planted it on there, and it grew really well. We had a good spot for it. Problem has sort of been marketing and time. Like, we're not big enough to have salesmen go, you know, or being out on the road all the time selling it. It's the kind of thing when we go to, Tofino or Victoria, Vancouver, we go into a restaurant, you know, they want to buy it and, you know, they love it. That's great. But it's always kind of been more of like a special thing, an impulse buy. Trying to get the repeat sales has always been really tough. Mm-hmm. We've been through sort of a few distributors who were sort of pushing it for a while, and they kind of moved on to other things. It was a wonderful run when we were doing it. It was it was great. It was an awful lot of fun.
Buying quite a bit of wasabi off you for a little while there, just because we were doing a wasabi aioli. Mm. So it was just nice to use the fresh wasabi. It's just got that little bit of a different taste than the horseradish wasabi that most people are accustomed to, right?
It's really different. Yeah. The taste, there's a little bit more sweetness to it. Mm-hmm. It's not quite as hot as
horseradish. As
the powdered wasabi, which is mostly horseradish flavored and colored horseradish.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, I find that stuff overpowering. Just the whiff that I get up my nose.
Well, you stop sniffing it.
I don't like it. Yeah. Try some guacamole. Oh, I remember that happened one time. not to me, but to another guy. One of the salesmen came into the kitchen and our chef said, "Hey, you should try this guacamole," and it was a big spoon of wasabi. Salesman wasn't too happy about it.
Well, we had a Mexican exchange student staying with us, and we took him to a Japanese restaurant. And it's not that he thought it was guacamole, but he thought that he could handle anything that was hot. He enjoyed really hot, spicy food. And so someone challenged him that he couldn't handle the wasabi, and he had this big spoonful of it, and I'm like, "Don't do it, Pedro." It's not like chili powder. It's totally different. It's not like a chili.
It's going to hurt.
He thought he was going to die for a bit. His eyes rolled back as his nose started to burn. I thought he was going to fall over in his chair.
Oh, dangerous stuff.
Yeah.
Wasabi, yeah. Laughs for a decade, yeah.
But that's kind of why we had some problem selling it to a lot of Japanese restaurants. They'd always buy like a little bit to have sort of under the bar for Japanese businessmen who would come through, and because they would really appreciate the fresh stuff.
Yeah.
But a lot of they wouldn't generally give it to everyone else because they didn't really feel that they appreciated the wasabi that people were putting, you know, loading it up on their sushi to get the nasal burn and out of it. And that's really not what the wasabi culture in Japan is really all about. So generally in Japan, they don't even, it's almost considered rude to add wasabi to a sushi roll.
Oh yeah.
In a restaurant. It's you're kind of insulting the sushi chef that he doesn't know how much wasabi to add to a particular roll by adding some stuff to it. So in North America, they're, you know,
the
they
the green powder, the green paste on your plate is, yeah. I always feel bad for sushi because I think sushi is one of those things that, you know, people train for years to become a true sushi chef. And then you walk into the local grocery store and they have a box of sushi for you.
Yeah, that's some employees back there rolling.
Yeah.
No training.
No training.
It's kind of like somebody gives them a couple of day lessons on how to do it.
He's got a bamboo roller and he struggles it out. So I know there's a few sushi chefs rolling over in their graves going, "Why?"
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's so easy to make, too, at home. It's a really easy dinner. You know,
well, just
to do a basic roll. A basic roll. It's super easy. Smoked salmon and a couple julienne vegetables and some rice. Mm-hmm. Nori roll or nori paper.
Probably someone grew rice around here. That would be good.
Yeah, I think there's wild rice around on Denman Island. I remember seeing bags of it for sale somewhere. Oh. Yeah, but yeah, it's not something that's around. But wild rice is different than white rice too. Wild rice is a
doesn't
seed
stick like
off
sushi.
A different plant. It's not even related to white rice.
I think it's quite different.
Yeah. But, I don't think anybody grows it around anywhere.
No.
Not that I'm aware of.
Well, I think, there is someone who is trying to grow some rice. There's that sake place on Granville Island that's producing sake in Vancouver.
Oh, yeah.
And they are looking for some plots. They have some test plots where they're trying to grow rice for making a sake. Yeah.
Oh, cool. That's neat.
So I don't know how that's going or, you know, what's come of that. But I know there's someone who is trying.
Yeah.
Someone's given it the...
It's wet enough if they can find something in the...
What do you think? The climate's got to be close to Japan and China. But I guess some areas. We don't have lowlands. It's all cliffs here.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Something to look into.
yeah. We'd buy a chunk of land on Forbidden Plateau and make some crazy terraces up there like they do over there in Tibet and stuff where they can farm on sheer rock, like, mountain faces.
So Brian, I wanted to also bring this up since we have you here. North Island College, you instructed a course there this year.
Yes. I taught the cooking component of the tourism and hospitality course up at North Island College.
That sounds very interesting. Like, was that a bit of a challenge for you, or how did you find that?
It was my first time teaching, so it certainly was. It was a bit of a challenge. It was an awful lot of. It was a lot of work, sort of getting all the prep and everything together. So, trying to get all your lesson plans done for the for the regular teaching part, and then having to. Because with them, it was sort of divided into two parts, where theory and a practical. So first half, we I think we had about 6 classes of theory. Then we went to the kitchen and we had about 6 classes in sort of practical cooking. And then they had 4 nights where they opened the bistro at North Island College. So half the class would be serving and half the class would be cooking the meals. And then the following week they would switch. So it was quite a lot of preparation to do in that period of time to get all your lesson plans done and to get the menu and all your food costing and ordering stuff together. And then to train them how to cook this menu. Because the people we have, they're more interested in sort of tourism, hotel management,
they're
serving.
They're looking to be the front end.
They're looking, they're front end people. And so we're trying to put together sort of, you know, a fine dining menu for these servers to cook for everyone. But it went surprisingly well. We had a great class and everything came together really well, for sure.
Well, I kind of like the idea because it's nice that, because I know there's always a distinction between front end and kitchen staff. And a lot of times they don't know each other's role. And there's always conflicts in kitchen. Doesn't matter how, because it's a high pressure place.
Yeah, and absolutely.
Front end, they're trying to make people happy. And the back end's just trying to survive.
Yeah.
Most days. But, you know, at least create something nice and make something that goes out, you know, so they have some respect in what they do. So it's always nice to have those people in the front sort of see what the back's doing. And I think in the same sense, it's nice to have the people in the kitchen there sort of see, realize that they're dealing with people out there. And at the end of the day, you just want to make them happy, right?
So. Yeah.
That's the biggest challenge in a restaurant, is make stuff good and make them happy, right? So.
Oh, I think they took away from that sort of a much greater appreciation of what happens in the kitchen. And I don't think as sort of future front-end managers and servers and stuff, they probably will think twice how they sort of treat and bark at the kitchen staff, because they have a much greater appreciation of what they're actually going through in the moment. When there's a whole bunch of orders and someone's screaming that, you know, they don't have their, you know, where's my entree? You know, it's like they can think back and go, oh, I know what that is like. And we did have moments like that.
The sheer panic.
I didn't put a salmon in. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
Get in the deep fryer. Nobody does that.
No.
Not anymore.
No.
Quickly cooking in the deep fryer.
Bad kitchen tricks.
Bad kitchen tricks.
Yeah.
That's why people don't do that anymore.
No. I got rid of my deep fryers.
Yeah. You don't have the option now.
I don't have an option.
Yeah. Well, that's...
I think we've had a good little chat.
Had a good conversation here.
Definitely have to thank Brian for sitting down with us. It's been quite enjoyable and learning a bit about him. And I do have one last question before you go. And it's about our Edible Valley, as we've been calling it, Comox Valley. What brings you here, and what keeps you here in the Comox Valley?
What brought me here originally was it was sort of because of the farm and the kind of, I was living in Vancouver and we couldn't see ourselves getting ahead. We couldn't see ourselves being able to buy a house. I've always sort of wanted to farm or be around sort of farms, and that I kind of saw as something that I wanted, that was important to me in my life. And the Comox Valley, which was sort of one of the places that we looked at that seemed to happen, that have a lot of that stuff around, and it seemed to be a nice community, and it had the Barn and Cafe for a smaller community, and there was a nice vegetarian restaurant at the time, and that seemed to have, you know, a really nice community feel around it. So that's some of the things that brought me to the valley. What keeps me here is just a lot of the farms, the people, just the beauty of the area. If you want to go up to the mountains and ski, or to the ocean and pick up driftwood and fish, and I'm not much of a golfer. Usually people throw golf in there or something that's important. It's not something that's not an issue for me.
Yeah, me either.
But
I go golfing to drive the cart around.
Awesome.
Yeah.
But, there's just so much to do, just the hiking, you know, swimming in the rivers and stuff. The fishing. I love, you know, going and picking mushrooms and stuff in the fall. And, there's so much stuff around here that, you know, I like to do. I can't really see myself moving elsewhere. You know, I think for myself, you know, for opportunities, there's probably a lot more opportunities for me in Victoria or Vancouver as a chef. There's a lot of nice restaurants working with, you know, better food and stuff, perhaps better pay. But I just, that the life, that lifestyle just doesn't, isn't what I want. And so I'd much rather, you know, take less pay and, you know, sort of work at a place that, you know, I like working at and it's fun and the people, they have everything around me. And so, yeah, that's kind of what's important. That's what keeps me here.
Great.
Good answer. Maybe when we do our episode in October, late September, early October, mushroom picking, you can join us.
Sure.
Yeah.
And
be fun to.
Yeah.
We did, our last episode was about mushroom picking and foraging, mushroom foraging. So we want to revisit that whole
episode. In the right season, yeah. That's, and maybe right, we'll go out and we'll do some picking and then we'll cook some and see what we can create.
That's right. Maybe have some more.
Yeah, that's, and there's even some summer mushrooms and stuff that I've found that I found a couple spots where the Prince mushroom.
Oh yeah.
It's sort of, it's related to our kind of button mushroom and it comes up in the summertime and it has a really nice kind of, what is it, vanilla kind of taste to it. It's it's quite yeah. So I'm kind of into the whole foraging thing too. So totally.
I figured that when I saw the hams in your fridge and the big garden in the back. I think I like this guy. All right. Well, I guess, John, you might want to cue the music and we'll
sign out here.
Sign out. Thanks for listening to the Edible Valley this week.
And we would...